From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, how racial disparities in incarceration in Wisconsin are emblematic of national trends.
We now have about seven times as many people in our prison system as we did in the early 1970s. We've also seen enormous racial disparities in the use of incarceration.
Then a local reporter and meteorologist spends 18 hours aboard an ice cutter on Lake Michigan. Our wine contributor offers tips on how to host a wine tasting in your home. And the Milwaukee Ballet hopes to push the boundaries of dance in tonight's winter series.
It's about letting other influences infiltrate ballet, which has been happening as long as ballet has been in existence. It's been infiltrated by folk dance and then by jazz dance. And so, you know, it's just kind of continuing that process.
It's all coming up on Lake Effect. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Tomorrow in Washington, President Obama is expected to announce a major new program aimed at improving the economic and employment outlook for young men of color. A report in the Washington Post says My Brother's Keeper initiative is an effort to use the power of the presidency to improve the lives of a demographic disproportionately affected by unemployment and incarceration. They're issues that have been the focus of WUWM's Project Milwaukee Black Men in Prison series as well. Wisconsin has the highest incarceration rate in the country, and Milwaukee County's numbers are even higher. More than half of African-American men in their 30s have spent time behind bars. The Washington, D.C.-based group, The Sentencing Project, tracks incarceration statistics and makes policy recommendations aimed at reducing incarceration levels nationwide. Mark Maurer is the group's executive director, and he joined us in November by phone. Maurer gave Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke a national snapshot of the issue of race and incarceration.
Well, you know, as we've seen the prison explosion of the last four decades, we now have about seven times as many people in our prison system as we did in the early 1970s. We've also seen enormous racial disparities in the use of incarceration. African-Americans are incarcerated roughly 6 to 7 times the rate of white Americans, Latinos about 2.5 times the rate of white Americans. And, you know, this comes at a point where U.S. incarceration rates are actually in the world lead of how we imprison our people. So we're both the most incarcerating nation. And then if we look at racial ethnic minorities, those figures are dramatically higher even than the national averages.
Is it possible to point to crimes and say this is a particular case where a white person would not be sentenced or would be sentenced at a lower rate than a person of color?
Well, it's a complicated story, and I think it's not just one where we can look at a certain point in the justice system, say on the day of sentencing. You know, there are many studies that look at, say, a white burglar and a black burglar on the day of sentencing, and, you know, do they get the same sentence in prison or in the community? And some studies say yes, and some studies say no, there's a little difference or so. But I think what we do know is that there's very much a cumulative effect of how cases are processed in the justice system. So decisions made by law enforcement on who to arrest, by prosecutors, what kind of charges, by the quality of your defense attorney, judicial decisions, each decision-making point may have an impact on the outcome of those cases. So I think we need to look at the sort of totality of decision-making to try to get a feel for how that plays out.
What got us to this point? The data shows, as you point out, that imprisonment rates and racial disparities also did not always look like this.
Right. Well, I think we've seen, you know, this explosion in incarceration. And just to be clear, you know, most people in prison have committed crimes and they've been convicted of that. Occasionally there's some innocent people, but most of the people have been convicted of violating the law. I think it's two parts in some ways. One is that, you know, public safety is traditionally a function of a variety of institutions. So it's family upbringing, it's community support, it's education, it's access to opportunity, and it's also criminal justice initiatives. And what's happened in recent decades is that I think we've gotten very much out of balance, that we've come to rely very heavily on the criminal justice system as our primary response to disorder, misbehavior, particularly in low-income communities of color. And in many respects, that set up a vicious cycle. As we pour more resources into the back end of the system, there's consequently less available up front for prevention, interventions, treatment initiatives that might head off the cycle of crime in the first place. We also have policies like, you know, tough on crime sentencing, the war on drugs, which have really exacerbated these figures and in many cases contributed to the racial disparities we're seeing as well.
But you would contend that just blaming, say, the Rockefeller drug laws or the three strikes and you're out kinds of policies maybe oversimplifies the problem?
Well, yes, I do. I think it's a broad problem. You know, many of the policies adopted in the last couple of decades, and many of them growing out of the war on drugs, have really made things considerably worse. California's three strikes and you're out policy, for example, just a couple of cases from there went to the Supreme Court. One man, his third strike was stealing three golf clubs from a sporting goods store. Another man, his third strike was stealing $153 of videotapes. The golf club thief was sentenced to 25 to life. The videotape thief, 50 to life. And these were sentences that were upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, which did not find that they represented cruel and unusual punishment. So clearly, we shouldn't condone people stealing golf clubs and videotapes. You know, whether this is a wise, let alone compassionate policy is a very different question.
What would you contend is the right role for prison to play in general in terms of the people who commit crimes, the victims of crime in society at large?
Well, I think what's often forgotten in some of the discussion is that 95% of the people we send to prison are coming home someday. Some will come home in a year, some in 20 years. But, you know, if all we care about is vengeance and punishment, we're selling ourselves short, I think. You know, it's in everyone's interest that when people come home from prison, they be better equipped, better prepared to make it legitimately in the community than before they were sent there. And, you know, in many respects, we've done just the opposite of what's needed in recent decades. As we've piled up the numbers in prison, the relatively limited programming that's always been available in prison in many ways is getting stretched even further. So opportunities for education, vocational training, substance abuse, counseling, and treatment are very modest in general, given the scale of the problem. So we take people from disadvantaged communities with many factors that at least contribute to their becoming involved in crime. If we don't address them very constructively, then all we've done is incapacitate people at a huge expense with little positive impact on their doing better once they get out of prison.
As you say, it doesn't seem like there is one single point of failure along the way, but where do you see enforcement fitting in this equation?
Well, I think, you know, police, you know, as do other actors in the justice system, you know, have a great deal of discretion available to them. And there's nothing wrong with that. Decisions need to be made all the time. But how that discretion is employed, we see this, you know, most clearly in the war on drugs, which, you know, has ramped up dramatically since the mid-1980s with pretty strong racially disparate outcomes. Essentially, we have really a two-tiered war on drug. When parents in middle-income communities discover their teenage son or daughter has a drug problem, they don't call up the police and demand that their kid be arrested. They try to get their child into the best treatment program they can find. When similar problems come up in low-income communities, those same resources are not available, and so it's much more likely to become a criminal justice problem. And so we throw police and prosecutors and prison cells at the problem there. So we have some very similar problems, but in many cases we approach it in very different ways, depending on really family and community resources available to try to address that issue.
You recently co-authored an op-ed in the Washington Times about this issue, and you pointed to the example of a man who essentially facilitated a drug deal and got a disproportionately stiff sentence compared to the other people that were involved. How is that particular example emblematic of what you see as wrong with the system?
Well, the case of Clarence Aaron was a football player at Southern University in the early 1990s. His crime involved he introduced one of his friends at school to an old high school friend who was a cocaine dealer, and it led to the sale of about 20 pounds of cocaine, a substantial amount. Clarence Aaron, the sort of go-between, didn't buy or sell or supply any of the drugs, but he refused to testify against the other people, refused to take the plea deal he'd been offered, and he ended up getting the most extreme penalty. He was sentenced to 3 life terms without parole. This was his first conviction. So he's been serving that sentence now for more than 20 years. This is an outgrowth of the federal mandatory penalties established for drug offenses back in the 1980s, you know, applying very harsh penalties based on the quantity of drugs, and that do not permit the judge to have any discretion into taking account his relative role in the drug trade, changes in his behavior, orientation while he's in prison, and the like. And the only way that Clarence Aaron can ever get out would be if he gets a commutation from the president. And commutations are extremely difficult to get at the moment, certainly. And so even though he's done all the right things one could expect in prison, he's still looking at spending the rest of his life behind bars for that one drug transaction.
Speaking of the president, the attorney general is basically working with states around the country to look at the issue of mandatory minimums. Do you think that effort is starting to tackle the right questions?
I think there's no question we're starting to see a change in the political climate on these issues. Attorney General Holder this summer delivered a high-profile speech in which he said there are now too many people in too many prisons for far too long. Pretty remarkable words coming from the Attorney General. And he and many other leaders of both parties have been very critical of the excessive use of mandatory penalties and how they've really distorted our sentencing policies and led to incarceration. Most notably, we're seeing now in Congress, which is, you know, quite well known for not exactly being very bipartisan these days, in the Senate, the Judiciary Committee is about to hear 2 bills that would reform mandatory sentencing, scale back the severity of those penalties. And what's most intriguing is the sponsorship of those bills.
Mark Maurer, thanks so much for helping us put this conversation in a national context.
And thanks for having me, too.
Mark Maurer is the executive director of the Sentencing Project. It's based in Washington, D.C. You can find links to the group's national data on incarceration rates, plus more from our Project Milwaukee series, Black Men in Prison, at WUWM.com. Maurer first spoke to Mitch Tyke in November at the beginning of the series. Coming up next, 18 hours aboard an ice cutter on the Great Lakes. We'll learn what that experience was like when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. The warming temperatures forecast for the Milwaukee area in the days ahead represent a welcome relief for many of us. But if they do happen, they'll also bring some challenges for getting around. Any snow that melts during the warmer days is likely to freeze as the temperature drops again at night. Fortunately for cities around the region, a major shipment of salt arrived last week at the port of Milwaukee. It was a difficult trip for the two Canadian ships that delivered it. They needed an escort from a Coast Guard ice cutter to make it through the Straits of Mackinac. Chris Gloninger is a meteorologist and reporter for WISN Channel 12 in Milwaukee. He spent an 18-hour shift aboard the ice cutter as it assisted one of the ships when it got stuck on its return trip through the Straits. His story on the experience will air tonight, but he joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke first to share what the experience was like.
There's constant vibrating and loud noises, and for the crew that's been on there for 60 days straight, our 18-hour taste of it was obviously very short, but mentally, physically, and even emotionally draining by the end of the day. Very different from a normal day at Channel 12.
How big a ship is it?
It's a 240-foot icebreaker. It's the United States Coast Guard ship Mackinac. They have several breakers that do cut through the Mackinac Straits, but this is their largest vessel that they have and most state-of-the-art.
And where did you join up with them?
We caught the ship at St. Ignace. That's where there's a Coast Guard station. We got on board. In fact, the crew didn't even get off. It was the crew that was stationed at that base that actually tied the ship up. We hopped on, and the crew actually stayed on board the entire time. So that's where the voyage began. It was a 38-mile trip out to the freighter that was stuck and about a 40-mile journey back.
Well, and so talk about the mission of the ship you were on. I mean, it was assigned specifically to assist this particular ship that had gotten stuck in the ice.
Exactly. There are only two primary ports in Lake Michigan that stay open year-round. In Milwaukee, we have one of those ports. So a lot of the reason, a big part of the reasoning why they keep this open, the straits open, is so that we can get our shipments of salt. Now, a little bit of background. We are the port for a 90-mile radius for salt. So we go to almost the Fox Valley, almost out to Madison, south down to northern Illinois. That's the scope. So it's a vital passageway that they need to keep open for the safety on the roads. One of the shipments got stuck. They frequently get stuck in the Mackinac Straits, and it's their job to go and free that vessel and keep that strait open.
There's either irony or coincidence in this, that the ship is bringing salt so that cars don't get stuck on the roads, and here it was getting stuck in the very same kind of conditions, only out in the lakes.
Seeing a 750-foot freighter stuck, I mean, you have to think about the weight of this vessel stuck in 2 feet of ice and basically is helpless out there. It's an amazing sight to see. And you see the engine, you see the water being turned up, and it's just not going anywhere. So it really is you look like – I mean, it appears you're out in the Arctic Sea, not in Lake Michigan, first of all, and you see this giant freighter that is just sitting there and awaiting. And they refer to it as a mission, as their operation. To their duty is to open up that passageway.
Well, so how do they do it? I mean, you know, you can sort of imagine a Coast Guard, you know, ice cutter going through an area and cutting away ice. But when you have a ship that's actually stuck in this ice, how do you get close enough to make a difference?
There are 58 crew members on board. Each have their own job, but most of them are going to be on the bridge. The breaker gets within an arm's reach of the 750-foot freighter. So imagine seeing two large vessels, probably bigger than most of the vessels that come in and out of port here in Milwaukee, being within an arm's reach. And what they do is they chew up the ice around the perimeter of the freighter, spit it out, and kind of eject it away. And that frees the freighter. And once they get enough forward momentum, then they trail about a half a mile behind.
And they do that until they get to the point in the water. They open water, essentially.
They do. And obviously this year, with 75 to 80% of the Great Lakes covered by ice, that's a challenge. So it's a much harder job. And it's a job that they've had to start earlier this year, 2 weeks earlier, and they'll likely continue because there is a waiting list. I've talked with many municipalities in our area that say that they're out of salt. And they're in touch with this salt mine in Goderich, Canada, and they've been put on a waiting list. So now they're playing catch up, and there's a 3-week span that they're going to be producing salt in the mines before they open it back up. And this secondary opening is very rare.
these are municipalities that are out of salt, even with this large delivery that did make it into port.
Exactly. And in fact, I spoke with one of the city managers out in the town of Waukesha, and he said every grain of salt is spoken for in those two 25,000-ton shipments.
You said this was a really intense 18 hours you spent out there draining. Was it scary?
It is scary because the captain, Michael DeVanzo, even said, even for us, we can get into big time danger when you're sitting there in ice and it can when the freighter was actually making entry into the port of Milwaukee, the hull was damaged severely. In fact, they actually had to do emergency repairs while it was here. So you're thinking about that. What if we're stuck out here? How long will it take us to get freed? Because this is the one boat that can actually get a massive freighter freed. They have other icebreakers, but we're on the one that's kind of the last resort and the machine that can actually get almost anything unstuck. So it's a thought that keeps going through your mind the entire time you're out there.
Well, right. This is kind of what we heard about down near the Antarctic where, you know, you had icebreakers that were freeing ships and then the icebreakers themselves were getting stuck.
Exactly. And I mean, you think, well, what can go wrong? But you're in a much similar situation to what they were down in Antarctica. You know, there's no land. I mean, the closest land is the Upper Peninsula, Lower Peninsula, Michigan. You're miles away. And it is scary. And, you know, there's so much ice coverage there that it seems like you're in the middle of some kind of Arctic climate.
Pretty cold on board, I'm guessing.
Cold is an understatement. And to say that this winter, considering I've been out in much of it covering the cold, that was the coldest I've been by far.
Well, what as you know, when you think about this this mission that you were on, what's going to be the enduring image for you when you think about it a year from now?
When I look back and the day started off sunny, but when there was no contrast, when you couldn't decipher between the sky, the snow that was falling, the ice covering the lake, it was so disorienting. And I don't know how they're able, obviously with GPS and that technology, but as an amateur being out there, it's a little frightening. And I think that's an image that will always stay with me.
Did you talk to people involved with the freighter about what the experience of actually being stuck was like?
They were not comfortable being interviewed. Their parent company does not allow them to go on camera. But you could actually see. You were so close that you can see the visual reactions that they're having. And they look relieved. They look happy. They're hanging off the boat. And, you know, it's a Canadian ship, but they're happy that the United States Coast Guard is there to the rescue.
Well, Chris, it sounds like an amazing experience. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Chris Gloninger is a meteorologist and reporter for WISN 12 in Milwaukee. His story about his time spent aboard the Coast Guard ice cutter Mackinac will air tonight during Channel 12's 10 o'clock newscast. Well, just in time for Valentine's Day, our wine contributor has a guide on hosting a wine tasting at home. Stay tuned for that when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. While this next interview isn't specifically about Valentine's Day, it's not hard to make the case that it's relevant ahead of the holiday. While some will celebrate with chocolate and flowers, others might be more tempted to bring a blush to their Valentine's cheek with wine. Lake Effect's wine contributor Ray Pfister joins Stephanie Lecce to offer some tips on planning a wine tasting in the comfort of your own home.
Really, that's what it is all about. It's planning how you're going to go about it. First of all, what is the point of the tasting? Are you trying to introduce people to new wines? Are you trying to educate them a little bit? Are you trying to just broaden their horizons? Or are you just simply doing it to have some fun? I've always followed a fairly simple pattern of doing blind tastings, which can be a lot of fun because it can become a bit of a competition. And everybody's always curious, this could be one thing. This could be another. Did a tasting recently where one of the women there had just been to a tasting that was all about the stemware. And it was fun to bounce things off her because she had a lot of information that was fresh. So planning is the big part. What are you going to do? Reds, whites, sparkling, that kind of thing. And then you go from there.
Now, I've been to professional wine tasting events, charity wine tasting events. What's the difference between those kinds of tastings and one that you would do in your home with good friends and loved ones?
Well, generally, those tastings are not blind. You can see exactly what you're tasting. You'll get the information from the person who's pouring. More often than not, they're distributors. Sometimes they're people from the wineries. And they're going to give you the information about what they taste in it, what they think you should taste in it. It's a lot of fun because it's a great way to educate yourself about wine because you can see it, feel it, and touch it. But I find the idea of doing blind tastings fun because they're challenging. I did one at my house years ago where one of my favorite wines was – I rated it 8 out of 10 and didn't even know it. So you learn a little bit about yourself.
If you want to do a blind tasting, how do you pick yourself? So that way maybe you're not getting an advantage over your guests.
You know, it's funny. It helps to have a little bit of short-term memory loss. When I bag the wine, I always try to get bags from the grocery store, nice, slim, typical liquor bags that are small, that aren't too cumbersome. And I'll mark them down as I go and I'll hide the list. And honestly, I don't remember. The only tip for me is occasionally I might recognize the top of a bottle. Certain wineries use certain types of bottles I might pick out. But I really try to make them nice and tight to the top so people can't really cheat. And people don't want to cheat. They want to learn. So again, make it reds, make it whites. I like doing reds because they're a little more complex and certainly a little harder maybe to figure out. I'll number them. I'll have, of course, a master list off to the side. I'll supply the guests with, of course, the names of the wines that are in the bottles. And at the end of the evening, I'll have them guess which was which, either by varietal or by label. And I'll have them sort of give me their, not their homework, if you will, but sort of a little ballot telling me which is which. And the results are sort of funny. It's hard. It's very hard. Unless you're a regular wine taster, it's very hard to pick things out. Varietals are a little easier, but to try and match it to the label, and I think most of the time is because you're comparing one wine to the other as opposed to having wine all by itself.
Now, obviously, the wine and the wine glasses are crucial pieces of equipment to have for your wine tasting, but what other items should you have available for your guests as you're putting this tasting on?
Some of the needed tools are you have to have water. You have to have either spit cups, which I recommend, kind of like those classic red or blue beer cups because they're a little more private, if you will. You can have a bucket, but some people who don't go to regular tastings aren't comfortable with the idea of spitting into a bucket, so they may end up drinking more than they want to. You don't want to have people leave a nice tasting drunk. It's dangerous and it's a bad idea. So if they spit, they're a little more comfortable. You should always have some kind of markers for the glasses. You can get the classic wine charms. I find these little – they look like flat donuts. They're just little pieces of paper that go on the bottom of your wine glass. They hook onto it where you can write your name on them. The whole idea of putting down your glass and having to pick up the wrong glass, nobody likes to do that. With a wine charm, I never remember what I had. Was it the little Monopoly figure? Was it the grapes? I don't know. So you have to add that. And again, fresh water so everybody can drink from it. And then, of course, it's nice to do it with cheeses, with crackers, something to clear your palate. And I also like to start it off with something different. If I'm doing reds, I'll start the evening off with a bottle of either champagne or sparkling wine or maybe a rosé, something like that, just to be completely neutral. They'll see what it is. And it just kind of gets the conversation going.
As the person putting on this wine tasting, how do you determine which wines you're going to include in the first place?
Well, number one concern is always budget. Do you want to get into something where you're putting $50 bottles of wine up there and something like that? Could get expensive if you're opening between 8 and 10 wines. You know, you can stay around the $10, $15 slot quite easily because there's plenty of great Argentinian, Chilean, Australian wines and certainly great Italians as well that you could do at that price range. But sometimes you maybe want to start at, say, a $5, a $10, a $15, $20 and just have it be progressive. So at the end of the night, there's always that price doesn't necessarily always equate to the quality or to what you're drinking and how that fits your own taste buds. But price is the first thing. And then if there's maybe a particular label or a varietal, I'll do all Cabernets or all Zinfandels. And just, again, keep it to what I think I can afford budget-wise. Sometimes I'll suggest to people you just go ahead and invite your guests to bring their own bottle and then bag it then and see if they can find out, if they know their wine well enough, what they brought, if they can pick it out.
Now, depending on what wines you've chosen, whether you're going by label or varietal, are you trying to have your guests determine which wine this is or to rate them?
I think I'm more wanting to turn them on to something new. For me, when I do my own personally, I always put in wines I've never tried to test my own palate, and then some favorites, if you will, some ringers in there for people to make their notes. You know, they'll give them a sheet of paper so they can write stuff down, and at the end of the evening go, oh, I had ABC, and that came out number one for me. That's great. I'd like to find that. Where did you get it? Not in the interest of promoting any particular wine store, but just saying, this is a great wine. What do you think? But of course, what you think is great wine, I may not agree with.
Now, if the host wants to make sure that they're including a couple of wines that they've never tried themselves before, where can they go to find some suggestions?
Well, number one, your local wine store. There's plenty of great wine stores here in the Milwaukee area. And these people who work at these stores, most of them, they're not working there for the buck. They're working because they like being around the wine. And they'll always make great suggestions. I've had so many great experiences at wine stores. And then you all of a sudden get into gabbing with these people as wine freaks. But on our newsletter, I do a section we started about 4 or 5 months ago called Ray's Picks, which are my personal preferences. And they vary in price. They're just wines I want to turn people onto. I don't rate them. I don't even put in any notes about what you're going to taste, what they're like. I just want people to be aware of them. These are ones I think are great.
You mentioned before that you want to make sure that your guests are having a good time talking about the wine, debating with each other. What are your suggestions for dealing with guests who maybe are a little shy around wine, don't know that much about it? What are some ways that the host can help them feel more comfortable in this tasting and make sure that the event isn't so stuffy they feel intimidated?
And it should never be stuffy. We were talking before the show. I just did one recently with a room full of people who 80% of the people I didn't know. So one is being assertive and meeting everybody. You're not going to remember everybody's names, but you just try. And have conversations with the people you don't know. You've already talked to the people in the room you know. You're just starting fresh with these. One woman I mentioned a minute ago had done a varietal tasting for glassware, for stemware, and that gave us an immediate area to talk about what she tasted, how she tasted, what they gave her. You really have to be one-on-one with people. You need to take the time to bring some people out of their shell. You can tell the beer drinkers in the room who are kind of like, well, I'm coming because of my wife or because of my husband. And once you start talking with them and you start pointing out the differences, they go, yeah, you know, it's all maybe a little more hospitality than average. And again, that's the social part of wine.
So if you want to host a wine tasting at your home with, you know, some of your good friends, do you yourself have to be so knowledgeable then to be able to lead people through the tasting properly?
Not at all. Many, many years ago, I had, strictly because of the job I had, it was about 30-some years ago, I had sort of an accidental wine cellar because I was a waiter at a restaurant and we used to get wine bottles for good sales. And I was married at the time, and I had all this wine, and we decided we'd do a tasting just to get rid of it. And we just all talked about what we were tasting. And that was, again, that was sort of the start of my wine education, where all of a sudden you're tasting this going like, wow, I like this. I've never tried a beignet before. I've never tried this before. So you don't have to be knowledgeable. You just got to know what you like.
Well, it sounds like to me we're going to have a lot of local home wine tasting events going on pretty soon after people listen to this. But I want to ask, what about the big event coming up in Napa?
Well, one of the two big events, of course, there seems like there's always something going on out there. Premier Napa Valley is coming up at the end of the month, and actually more like around the 20th, 21st. And this is an event for the trade only. So it'd be distributors, retailers, media, which is the category I fall into. And these distributors and retailers can bid on wines that are made for the event. And it gets fairly pricey. That's not the kind of stuff I'd be able to bid on. And in the end, the money that comes from that event funds Auction Napa Valley, which is in June.
Well, we've had you in the last couple of years after you've attended Premier, and you've always brought back some really interesting factoids and information, knowledge on new trends in wine, and even some clips from interviews you get to do with winemakers.
I learn a lot every time. One thing I preface, especially when I do tastings, I am no wine expert. I'm an enthusiast. I'm uncomfortable with the term expert. I just love it. But I go to these events and I learn every time. And especially now going out to Napa, you know, California, I'm sure a lot of people have read, has been in a drought, a horrible drought for 3 years. And this is not good for the valley, in Napa Valley especially, because there is a certain amount of rain the vines need. Well, I was looking at my iPhone the other day for the forecast, and all next week is nothing but rain. rain. So I think things are finally starting to ease up a little bit. I've heard some of the winemakers pruning in the rain, and we're happy to be doing it.
Well, Ray, I look forward to having you back in when you get back from Napa and telling us about what you learned.
Great. Thanks, Stephanie.
Our wine contributor Ray Pfister runs the wine blog and podcast Life Between the Vines. He also owns Fifth Floor Recording in Milwaukee's Third Ward, and he spoke with Stephanie Lecce. Valentine's Day can sometimes be rough for people who are unattached. But in the game of love, optimism abounds thanks to technology, as Lake Effect essayist Heidi Friedrichs would attest.
A cross-dresser wasn't what I had in mind when I logged into my online dating account the other night. She, he, had lots of colorful pictures of herself, himself, in a flowery dress, but it seems to me that she, he, should have been on the other side of the school gymnasium. I sure wasn't going to wink at her. You never know what you'll see on a dating site, which is why I find them so intriguing. I swore I would never go on another site after one fiasco when the guy I met up for coffee turned out to be about 20 years older than his photo. Not to mention he wore white pants. Total deal breaker. Speaking of deal breakers, I've discovered a few more brought to my attention from well-meaning friends who counseled me after their own trials and errors online. Not married? Don't bother. He's afraid to commit. Legally separated? He's still leaving his marriage. You better hold off. Has four kids and lives with four kids. Oh boy. Lives in North Carolina, Texas, New Jersey, California, any state outside of Wisconsin. Why even bother unless you plan on starting a whole new life with a complete stranger, including his family? I have explored the dating sites for a year or so now that I am single, mostly out of curiosity about other singles and how they play the dating game. Match, OkCupid, Our Time, and eHarmony have hooked me with their clever tools like winks, flirts, personal questionnaires, and other tricks for making me look good while catching someone's eye. As someone who is extremely shy with strangers, especially men, hiding behind a computer screen is way easier than walking up to a cute guy in a bar and asking him what his favorite sport is. Part of me feels like I'm cheating when I talk to more than one guy at a time, even though that's what you're supposed to do, I'm advised. And it totally lacks the spark of a real face-to-face connection, I admit. But what's the alternative? A blind date? Not gonna happen. It's funny how you could be standing in line at the hardware store next to someone relatively attractive, and you instantly become speechless and your eyes dart away. You'd think this personality trait would fade with time and maturity, but it doesn't. On the other hand, there's my charming friend Barbie. She isn't shy at all around guys and blurted out to the single, helpful hardware man one snowy Saturday morning, "We don't have boyfriends, so we're looking for sleds." Even that friendly statement made me cringe, and I made my way silently over to Garden Supplies while she chatted with the sales clerk. Go online, and the high school introvert transforms into most popular girl status for me. No inhibitions here, and the atmosphere is always upbeat. Who, me? Travel? All over the world. Am I athletic and toned? Well, that's a matter of opinion, but in my opinion, I am. Do you like dogs? Sure, yes, of course. But I live in an apartment with a cat. Do you like the outdoors? Yes, but I work in an office 5 days a week and stay inside when the temperature drops below 10 degrees. How about those Packers? I love the Packers, Brewers, Admirals, any sport. That's always the right answer. I think we all agree that it's a kick writing and posting photos of ourselves for others to see. Who doesn't want to be admired and liked? Think Facebook. What would any of us ever do without the thumbs up icon? It's the same with online dating sites. A couple of flirts or winks in your inbox and you begin to think your middle-aged self is not so bad looking after all. So, I took a lot of time to find the best photos of myself and to write my profile. Not too self-serving, but just enough to highlight my good points. And through this process, I've discovered I have several, at least. Photos show my fun side, but I don't overdo it with lots of pictures of me and my friends because then I appear like I'm having way too much fun on my own. And that's what I look for with men and their snapshots. But guys, come on. I'll be frank. Posting a photo of yourself staring into your computer with your face taking up the entire screen is not attractive. Neither is a nude torso shot. Oh, let's please also stop with the selfies and photos of sunsets and beaches. I want to see you, not your vacation. Finally, Romeo, do not write how great a lover you are. Not interested in that yet. Remember, girls just want to have fun.
Lake Effect essayist Heidi Friedrichs lives and writes on Milwaukee's West Side. We'll take one more break and then meet the three choreographers responsible for the Milwaukee Ballet's Winter Series performances. That's coming up next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect, and I'm Bonnie North. During this dark and cold time of the year, the Milwaukee Ballet traditionally heats up the Marcus Center with its Winter Series. It's a yearly performance of three new dance works made for the ballet. The aim of the series is to challenge the traditional definitions of ballet, to stretch the boundaries of both the dancers and the audience. This year's series gets underway tonight with new works by American Gabriel Lamb, Italian Luca Vigetti, and Australian Tim O'Donnell. O'Donnell is also a member of the Milwaukee Ballet Company. I sat down with all three of them in one of the rehearsal rooms at the company's headquarters on 5th and National, and I asked what it meant to them to be pushing the boundaries of dance. O'Donnell began.
I think in this case, pushing the boundaries of ballet really relates to the fact that it's a classical company. When I'm choreographing, my movement is always quite contemporary, but when it comes to working primarily with classically trained dancers who actually work mainly as classical dancers, it's really about getting them to break down their classical structure a little bit more.
As Tim said, it's very true that a choreography is sometimes, say, conditioned to work in a certain way by the environment it's in. You know, if the company is a company that mainly does a classical repertoire, is led in a way, sometimes by condition that have actually little to do with the choreographic process. It's maybe because the dancers meanwhile rehearse classical ballet, so their body it naturally flows into that direction. But however, on my own end, I want to say that it is not a question for me to push the boundaries. I just do what I do. And then if it's perceived that way, that's fine with me. I'm happy. But I do just to follow what Tim was saying, that I do feel that dance is a language, and as every language is in a constant development. So even the what we call the classical ballet technique has developed over the years. And if we look even just a picture of the 19th century, when we all agree that the language we're using now stems from, at least that's the closest thing we can think of, we can see that was radically different. I do consider dance a language in development and that it constantly redefines. Ballet, however, is a different matter because it's a ballet and dance, or this ballet is a genre, I would say, of theatrical dancing. So there's almost two different things that we are talking about. Like, I mean, to be perceived like a choreographer that pushes the boundaries, I think it's very flattering to all of us, rather than be, you know, a conservative. Winston Churchill used to say that a young conservative is an idiot, and he was probably right.
And for you, Gabrielle? So for me, what remains of ballet in my work is sort of an attention to form and to detail. And I think that sometimes I work with more contemporary dancers. The dancers here at Milwaukee Ballet they do have beautiful classical technique. And so automatically I start really going for precision, maybe, whereas I would push certain other qualities if I were working with more contemporary dancers.
Also, like what? What other kind of qualities might you push?
I might push a lot more covering space, for example, or maybe explosiveness, although I don't really do that very much. So, yeah, I think I automatically go more for precision because I know they can do it and their bodies are trained for that. Also, a lot of the movement that I start out the process with comes from my own body. I have to come prepared with something. And so I try to sort of in between creations to learn more about other dance forms. I do a lot of contemporary dance anyway, but when I'm in New York, I take some hip-hop classes. And then when I improvise the material I'm going to use for a creation like this, some of that will make its way in. Now, it has nothing to do with the aesthetic of hip-hop at all. That won't show up in my work. It's more about a different kind of coordination than what ballet dancers are used to, because hip-hop is very coordinated. So I think it's about letting other influences infiltrate ballet, which has been happening as long as ballet has been in existence. It's been infiltrated by folk dance and then by jazz dance later on. And so, you know, it's just kind of continuing that process.
Just adding to the pile of things that you draw from. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, and for all of you, I know, Tim, you're a dancer here now. You're part of the company. You've actually danced in some of his work, in Luca's work, and you were a dancer as well.
Yes.
Is it a requirement to be a dancer to also be a choreographer? I mean, do you need to know
I would say so.
Yeah?
I think it's a, well,
I know some choreographers who haven't really had dance careers.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes things much harder for them. They struggle much more. I know one choreographer I worked with who came from a film background, and he had beautiful ideas about especially transitions and storytelling, but he really struggled a lot with the vocabulary.
Yeah. I mean, you're right, and I'm not saying dancing careers,
right.
But I think you should, in the choreography is made of movement, so I think you should have an understanding of movement. In that sense, you have to, and it's difficult to have an understanding of movement if your own body doesn't have that sense. It doesn't mean that yourself you have to have been a great dancer or a skilled dancer, but that your own being has an understanding of what movement is, because that's what you construct your form with. Then, yes, no, I don't think you need to have... No, you can come from a different background and being very interested in movement and learn about that.
At some point, you have to invest in learning about movement,
right.
Though.
Yes, it's hard not... I mean, it's like being a composer without knowing what it means to play an instrument at all.
Right.
I mean, you can, theoretically, you know, because music exists in a written form. But are we talking about music? You know, I'm not sure. You know, it's practice, you know, in a way. It's a necessary
component.
At least for me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I find hard to think that one can...
Because your brain works in certain ways when you move and you watch other people moving and you develop certain analytical ways of thinking about movement that it just takes time and time and time.
Yeah.
And Tim?
My first job in Western Australia actually was working with a Finnish choreographer called Jorma Uttinen. And from my understanding, he actually didn't have dance background at that point.
He had been some kind of contemporary dancer.
Yeah, he was.
Because he was working as a visual artist when
not
I.
Not extremely trained, though.
No. Yeah. But he was a very important dancer of his generation, there's no doubt. You know.
Yeah. But definitely didn't have some
ballet
training. Even the training he had was more experience rather than the sort of structure that I went through.
Mm-hmm. Right, because you went through ballet school, you all did that kind of training. And so it's so interesting to me to kind of explore where those boundaries cross, you know, whether, as you say, it's that kind of structure that comes from that classical training. But then there's also, you know, sort of the more free form of quote-unquote modern dance or jazz dance or other things that I think it's shaping ballet in such an interesting way and changing it. And yes, we can still go back to Swan Lake, but you can also do what you guys are doing and taking these forms and kind of, again, to borrow the PR phrase, pushing the boundary a little bit. What is it like to work on a series like this? I mean, you're not necessarily working together as choreographers, but you're on the same bill. Do you talk to each other about what you're doing and how it might or might not complement each other?
No, we haven't in this case, as far as I know. But just simply because our schedule, you know, we are often playing against one another in terms of the schedule. And also because I think we respect our, you know, if you want to talk about something, you're free to. And the process, in a way, is private.
Of the
preoccupation that the other, you know, and then at the same time, I feel that if to talk to Tim or Gerber would, and sometimes we do, it would free me from some preoccupation. I'll do it, and then they'll do it, you know.
Right.
Sometimes
but
it's nice to talk to another choreographer.
Absolutely, yes, but you know, it's. I think it's just a natural, you know, that if we feel that is necessary, we don't have any problem if in exchange or.
working in something like the Winter Series, what does this do for you as choreographers that you might not get from commissions elsewhere? Or is it pretty much the same? Is you're just working on new pieces and you're working for this particular company?
Every commission is different. I think here I have a little more time, which I like. Being in a time crunch is not fun, and I know that one of the commissions I have coming up, I'm supposed to make a 20-minute piece with 40 hours of rehearsal, which to me that's very, very short. And right now I expect to finish maybe today or tomorrow, which will have me at 3 hours of rehearsal per minute of choreography. So I somehow have to get it down to 2 hours per minute. So here I feel comparatively
relaxed
and calm, and like yeah. I can try things that might or might not work out, whereas with that I feel like I have to just go with what I know will work.
So maybe it's not quite as creative as you might like.
I want to find a way to be creative about it, because there's nothing that bothers me more than just falling back on something that I've done before because I can't think of anything else.
Tim?
I think the Milwaukee about audience has come to recognize the Winter Series and in the off year the Genesis Series to be a more innovative program. They know what to expect. Sometimes at the Spring Series in the Marcus Center, it can go into a very classical place, whereas the Winter Series traditionally is a lot more contemporary, a lot more modern, a lot more experimental. And I don't necessarily think that, I mean, I haven't been like trying to be experimental as much as I feel quite free to just do what I want in this. I don't feel like I have to be ticking any boxes other than being myself.
Yes, no, I think, well, in my case, this is the first time I'm working with Milwaukee Ballet, so it's certainly different in that sense. But yes, I agree with both Tim and Gabriel say. You know, it's mysterious. Sometimes I have a lot of time at disposal and it's not achieving anything. Sometimes I have little time. And because I have little time, I'm forced to find solutions. So it's mysterious in that sense for me. You know,
you never can tell what's going to take a long time unnecessarily, and then what's just going to create itself.
Somehow you have to often find a strategy that fits the conditions. I mean, I would say these are, you know, good condition. They are average condition in terms of the timing. You know, they're compared to, for this type of company, I would say. I mean, it's. Balanchine notoriously say that the inspiration comes on union time. You know, and so that I think he trained himself to come up with solutions, and it's very difficult because you get tense and then you're scared. You think, oh my God, what am I going to do now?
I'll just
do whatever, you know, I did in the other piece, right. And that worked, and you know, people liked it, and I mean, I'm simplifying, but you know, it can happen certainly that way. That you work yourself up, and then your mind is not free. There's no question. It does teach us something. Even that is.
It's not a guarantee.
No, it's not guaranteed.
No. Well, I want to thank you all for taking time out of rehearsal day and everything to talk to me. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Milwaukee Ballet's Winter Series gets underway tonight at Eline Hall, and it runs through Sunday. If you go, you'll see the company perform Gabriel Lamb's Happenstance, Luca Vigetti's Scene 6, and Tim O'Donnell's Talk to Me. I spoke with the three choreographers at the company's headquarters on 5th and National, and there is a link to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. I'm Bonnie Noor. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. Lake Effect returns tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.